You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
You don't seem to be talking a lot of politics these days. Yeah, that whole thing, you had me at hello, right? I don't know. I'm concerned. So, anyway, we'll talk about that another time. Joining me is the Gunner, and I was playing some mail call episodes. And I mean, he was so funny in that show. I mean, that's where I watched him the most was like, I was out on the History Channel. You'd see the mail call and he would do stuff like the things that I love the most is when he would say he was doing a comparison of the M14 and the M16 and he's talking about the M14 and he looks at it at the camera and he says, and if you don't know what that means, then too bad for you, right? He says something like that. He said something like out of our culture. It's just funny. Or when he was going to break, he would say, all right, fat body, stay in your seat. You don't need another donut, you know?
And yeah, he capitalized on that whole thing.
And all he did was play. Mike, you could have been a millionaire. You could have been a Hollywood celebrity playing Gunny Musselman.
No. No, man. We knew each other. Right. You know, every time we'd run into each other, he's Gunner, you know, and he's a good guy. Right. And, you know, I had asked him one day, I forget how I phrased the question, but basically what I was asking was, hey, is it good to be Lee Emery? And he looked, you know, he's kind of lit that smile and he looked at me and he said, never been better, brother. I mean, he just, you know, he did. He capitalized on his. He didn't, and he wasn't really a sellout, you know. So, I mean, he did a lot of stuff behind the scenes for veterans, for the military. Right. He was always, you know, no matter what. I mean, I've seen that guy sign tens of thousands of autographs, and the next one come up, and he's just excited like it was his first one that day. You know, I couldn't do that, man. I'd be like, hey, get out of my personal space right now, all right? Let me finish my coffee.
Really? I don't know. He was never a gunny, right? He rose to the rank of staff sergeant. Staff sergeant, right? He rose to the rank.
The commandant made him
honorary.
You know, honorary, promoted him.
And then, he was an aviation guy.
Yeah, he wasn't a grunt. That was the crazy thing. He was a drill instructor, though.
Right, right. MCRD.
But he was an avionics guy. He was an air winger.
Right. Swinging with the wing. And you know, how hilarious is it that, right, all he did was play the part of, like, a no-shit gunny, right?
Yeah.
And
of what a real-life gunny should be.
Right. And then people just ate it
up.
Oh, my God. It was crazy. But, again, I loved it because of the funny shit gunny say. And he was awesome at it, right? He was awesome at it. You'd hear it, like, you know, fat body and all the rest of the stuff he would say. It's just, like, common terms in the Marine Corps. And he did it well. When did you first meet him?
Oh, man. I met him, I think, at a SHOT Show when he was just becoming a pretty big guy.
Explain what a SHOT Show is. So
SHOT Show is like...
1987, he's in Full Metal Jacket. 1978, he starts his career. I think he's appears in The Boys of Company C in 1978. So he's long career in the entertainment
business. Yeah, and actually one of his best movies I really liked, and it's probably not on there, is Purple Hearts.
Oh, I've never seen it.
It's about a doctor, a Navy doctor, love story, Cheryl Ladd from, you know.
Oh.
Yeah. And there's a really good scene in there with Cheryl Ladd, by the way. if you know what I'm talking about. But, so he's in that, and he's being really, you know, he's talking to this lieutenant, and he's like, all right, lieutenant, did you get your pistol? Yes, Gunny. Did you get your ammo? Yes, Gunny. Is it loaded? Yes, Gunny. And he's like, you know, he just had a gun on his first patrol, and then he's like, lieutenant, we all know you're a lieutenant. Hide these bars. You don't need to go out there, you know, and he just said, well, then they're going on patrol, and they get in a big firefight, and the lieutenant dies. And so the Gunny, you know, Lee's like, all right, lieutenant, I'll write you a good letter. I'll write you a good letter. You're a good kid. I mean, he's just this simple shit like that. But he's also in there where they're like a fire base. It looks like they're a caisson. And he said, you know, the doc's like, I got to get out there because there's wounded Marines outside the wire. And he goes, pulls his doctor back in, and he's like, doctor, you get your ass in, you know, in the surgical room. Those are Marines out there. They'll bring their wounded back in. You know, I was just... That's him.
No, I mean, he was wonderful at it. He was absolutely wonderful. I have a couple questions, though. We watched a couple episodes, or listened to a couple episodes. Well, not episodes, but he'd do answer a letter about the difference between the M14 and the M16. We've done weapons history. Why did we field a weapon in the middle of a conflict? What drove that? Was the M14 performance that poor? What was the lore?
No, we talked about this. The driving factor was General Curtis LeMay.
The Air Force guy? Was he chairman of the Joint Chiefs?
He was in charge of the Air Force, whatever that title is.
Chief of Staff of the Air Force.
Yeah, there's an actual really good, it's like the Pentagon Papers. It's like this whole, and I actually have a copy of it. I can't pull it up right now, but it talks about the whole, how the M16 came about. You know, it was General May, you know, as they say, the M16 everybody needs to understand, the M16 was the rifle that was never supposed to be. It should have never, ever happened, ever, because of all of the shit that went crazy about it. But, I mean, they were still using M1 Grants. an M14 in Vietnam.
Right.
You know, and then it was, you know, so Armalite in the early, in the early 50s, mid 50s, Armalite came to life, and you know that's why it's called an AR-15, it's Armalite rifle. So Armalite was a division of, I want to say, not Northrop Grumman, but it was a big airplane manufacturer in California, and they started doing this with Eugene Stoner, right? Mm-hmm. So they were working on with Eugene Stoner, and they come across this rifle. So the first one was the AR-10, the Armalite rifle Model 10, which was the 7.62 bullet. And they didn't like, so they wanted a smaller bullet. And it was LeMay that kept on pushing for this and, you know, basically coming out and coming out. But you think about the AR-10 came out in 1955. 55, dude. You know, this is, Korea War is just over. And Stoner comes out with the working model of the AR-10. And so, and then it was just after, so 1955, the AR-10 comes out. What year do you think the M14 hits?
The M14 would have been a Korean War event, post-Korean War. Wait, the M1 was in Korea. Post, I would say 1956, 57, the M14?
So it came out, I think, 1954. Okay. Because the Army had just announced that they were going to go with M14. And this is literally right after the AR-10 has been built. So now there's this whole, like, wait a second. So they create this board. They come in. Eugene Stoner's got some WASTA. Armalite's got some WASTA. LeMay comes in. And they come in for this whole, you know, what are we going to do with this rifle? Because, you know, at first it was pretty good. So then the AR-10, they go back. They don't want to fight against the M14, so they scale it down to a .22 caliber. So thus is born the AR-15. And then there's like another general. I forget his name, but he gets involved, an Army general, and then it's the Air Force who actually pushed this thing through as a replacement in the Air Force. So the AR-15 comes about 1958. It hits the streets. The Army's testing it. Air Force is testing it. Marine Corps doesn't want nothing to do with this thing. They don't even look at it. And then, but it's what really the driving factor behind this is the lightweight, low recoil. Because if you've never fired an M14, dude, oh, I mean, that's a beast, especially on full auto. I mean, it's a great rifle. Don't get me wrong. I mean, it's a beautiful looking rifle.
You know, I've never fired that thing. I own an M1 Garand. I'm curious, what's the major difference between, other than the magazine, between the Garand and...
No, that's about it. It's the magazine. It's the inner workings of the box magazine that gives... Because if you look at the bolt and upper receiver in M1 Garand and the M14, they're very similar. I mean, there's a little bit of differences because of the box magazine. You can insert in box magazine. But other than that, they're almost identical.
What about it looks like the flash suppressor is different, longer? Is that so? You see, it looks like the barrel is longer on the M14. Is that just the suppressor they use?
Yeah. So the on the M1 Garand, there's no flash suppressor. It's just a rifle.
Right.
That was the initial attempt to control muzzle rise and all that stuff. It really didn't. That muzzle brake on the M14 doesn't do anything other than it looks cool. It's badass. It's long.
Right, it does. It does. You know, Mike, but there was no issue relative to the performance of the M14. It was just this push for, you know, the synthetic lighter weight. And then,
synthetic, yeah, right. Instead of wood, very lightweight. I mean, when you compared the AR-10 back in the day to the M14, it was night and day.
Right.
And, you know, so... the biggest magazine that they had, and no one was doing 30-round magazines yet. You know, I think the biggest magazine that they had was a 25-round magazine. So they had 10s, 20s, and 25s. So there was not a big, huge difference, but there was a huge difference because, you know, not like today, but the 8 or 15 back then only weighed like 6 pounds, dude, empty. 6 pounds.
Right.
I mean, when you looked at an AR-15 or an M14 fully loaded, and then fully loaded was like 6.1, 6.2 pounds. And then an M14 back in those days was double that. You know, it was 14-something pounds, 12 to 14 pounds.
But there was no hue and cry from either the Army or the Marine Corps to replace a weapon.
Not at all.
You know, to me, the biggest difference when you shoot, you know, and I have a Grand and an M4, is, you know, the whole buffer assembly and that shock absorber in the stock of an M16. I remember the first time I bought it and brought it home. My sons, you know, are used to shooting the Remington 870, and they're young. You know, I think John was 16, Patrick would have been 13, and they would shoot the Grand and the 45. I mean, and all those weapons, right? They're serious weapons. They kick, and you better be holding it like a man, or else it's gonna kill you. And they fired the M4, and they both of them started laughing. They're like, "Oh my God, it feels like a BB gun compared to those other devices, which you better be ready for." So it was very, very interesting in terms of just recoil of modern weapons.
It's really cool, yeah. And so, you know, the M16 had a buffer assembly, which, you know, travels down the length of the stock that when the bolt comes back, that's how the gun is cycled, you know, the operation of the cycling of the gun for extracting and feeding again, going into that. But more importantly, it's just the overall balance. And so when the Army did the testing for at Fort Benning, you know, remember, now there's no war going on, so there's really no requirement, right? This is between Korea and Vietnam. So now we're talking about the late 50s. I think we started putting advisors in Vietnam, like, maybe as early as – because Dien Bien Phu, happened when, 58, 59?
Yeah, I want to say 58, 59.
So the French were just getting their asses kicked in Indochina, and so they're leaving. We start sending advisors, I think, in the early 60s.
1954.
Is what Dien Bien Phu happened?
Yeah. The Battle of Dien Bien Phu was a climatic confrontation in the first Indochina War between the French Union's Far Eastern Expeditionary Corps and the Vietnamese. Date March 13th to 7th May 1954.
Wow, I thought it was later.
Yeah, so did I. I thought it was in the latter half of the 1950s.
Because, yeah. Okay, so they leave. It's not until Kennedy really comes to power that we start sending troops. You know, he's pressured, so he sends advisors, and then LBJ, of course, kicks the war off, but so this is in between war. There's no requirement for this. And plus the ammunition was the biggest problem. Because the funny thing, you know, when Stoner built this thing, there's no ammunition that could really shoot it yet, you know, successfully. So we build a gun, and then we try and build the ammunition for it. Which, again, is a recipe for disaster. So if we do that today, you know, it's horrible. So we try and build weapons around bullets now. We try and design and further fabricate the bullet to its most optimal, you know, capabilities. And then we can build something around that. You don't build a gun and then go, all right, now what are we going to do with this? Oh, yeah, we got to build a bullet. So that's what they do. They build a bullet, and that's where the fabled 55 grain. That's the shit that I shot when I first came in. So did you.
Right.
You know, and what it was it was just nothing but a 222 special, because that's, you know, bigger bullet, 55 grains. I mean, that's nothing, dude. And those things were kicking out at 3,200 feet per second, because that was, remember, part of your lore on your rifle. You had to learn was the chamber pressure is 55,000 pounds per square inch, and chamber feet per second is 3,200 feet per second. Firing a 55 grain bullet, you know, Because they'd ask you that boot camp. And then that area of Point Tart.
Yeah, that along with the where the hem line should be on a WM's dress. So that you could be meritoriously promoted.
Right. Mm-hmm. So they do the testing. There's some differences. They changed from the 25. That's where the 25, that's why I say if you can find a 25-round magazine original, like, and that's worth some bucks, man, because they never made, they stopped making those things. They only made 10s, 20s, 30s. But the 25-round magazines from back in 1958 that would fit an AR-15 are sought after. Not a replica, but a root and original. Anyway. And then, so the Army goes back, they do the testing. It kind of doesn't do very well. I mean, some people are impressed, all because it's like a plastic rifle. And this is like Butcher, you know? That's what you gotta understand. If you're 1958 and you're holding an AR-15 and it's composite, lightweight aluminum, it's not made out of steel, right?
Right.
Lightweight aluminum, it's got plastic front grips, it's got a plastic stock, it's got a plastic pistol grip. And, you know, it's, the pistol grip and the carrying handle were revolutionary. You know, it was like, wow, we never, I mean, you don't put pistol handles on rifles. And a carrying handle, wow, we could carry it, you know. And it was just crazy, dude, crazy. And so 1960 is when LeMay jumps in there. And it's not really going anywhere. It's going back and forth, going back and forth. And you know, so here's the story, and this is the crazy thing about it. So I think it's 1960 again. It's 4th of July, right? Curtis LeMay and a Colt salesman are out talking, because that's what you could do in 1960, and they put watermelons out there on a range at you know, 50, all the way up to 100, maybe 200 yards. Three watermelons, okay? This is what happens, and I know, and I shouldn't do it. Three watermelons. They give LeMay the rifle, a fully loaded AR-15. He shoots the watermelons.
Yeah.
They explode.
Right.
LeMay goes back and orders 80,000 rifles on the spot. He shot three watermelons. Curtis LeMay. Okay? And he goes and orders 80,000 rifles. Well, LeMay can't do that. So Congress steps in, says no, but this is where the whole, like, push, like, shit, Air Force wants 80,000 of these things? Yeah, they gotta be, you know, like, this is what starts. But it's if you look it up, Curtis LeMay shoots three watermelons, and that's the watermelons, you know, is what launches the AR-15 into history. And it's so stupid. It's so crazy. But it's just crazy enough and stupid enough to be real. And so that's what, again, goes through the whole thing, goes through the thing. And it's not until like 1961 that they approve like, you know, 10,000 rifles or something like that to go to the Air Force. Not as 80,000. Cause LeMay is out there with the salesman and he's like, after he shoots these watermelons, I'm sold, boys. I want 80,000 rifles right now. He signs it, not realizing that even though, yeah, you're the chief of the Air Force.
Give me that clipboard, son.
Where's my credit card? Hey, get my credit card. Get the Air Force credit card.
Where do the trucks need to go? Gunny? We don't have gunnies. It's tech sergeant to you.
Yeah. But if you read this, it's a really good, and I don't know if there's any books about it. I should write a book about
it. What about the decision to deploy it to units in combat, to field it into Vietnam?
I mean, so that doesn't happen until, so the Air Force is the first one to get it.
Right.
And then, again, it just very slowly, very, very slowly, do a few people get it. So troops in 1961, 1962 in Vietnam are using the AR-15.
They are.
Yeah, and so that's what people, and I always get Vietnam vets to say, no, it didn't come in until 1966 or 67. No, it didn't come to you. Right, it didn't come to you. Doesn't make it, that's just because you never saw it, doesn't make it true. the AR-15 came in to Vietnam at the very onset. And so it's getting, and at first it's getting great reviews, man. I mean, it's lightweight. It's not carried. The South Vietnamese were impressed with it. You know, they like it because they're little. So everything is a like. And remember, this is the first one before the charging handle. The charging handle is not added until later. So the first one doesn't have a charging handle on it. So if there's any problem, it gets stuck in the mud or anything like that, there's no way to assist the bolt forward, you know, to push it forward.
Let me, hey, Mike, so was there any difference in terms of the operation of the weapon itself? Was there a reason that the M16, so the story of the forward assist on the rifle is that it jammed between the moisture, between the dirt.
Sure.
Was the M16 more susceptible to that stuff than the M14? Or
because you're talking about more mass. I mean, there's a lot of difference. There's mass.
Right.
When you pull back an M14 and let that thing go, there's a lot more mass. There's a lot more inertia. A lot more, you know, things happening there than the M16. Even though the bolt steel and everything else, it's not the same.
So would it have been the larger round, you know, having more blowback, it could handle some debris in the system where...
There's a lot of things, yeah. It's just the design. The M14 is a lot more open design.
Right.
You can pull, you know, if you look at M16, it's a very closed design. I think it's only got... You know, if you look at 360 degrees, I think it's 25 degrees of that whole circle or 30 degrees is actually exposed. The rest of it is all encased within metal. So it's very, very difficult to keep clean. You know, and that's the biggest problem that it had. And plus, the M14 and the M16, this is where the problems lie is, you have seasoned, hardened guys that have been in the military for a while, even the young guys. But this is what they grew up with. They had the M14. This is all they know. It's just like the Marines. Hell, I'm an expert. I shot 3 times on the rifle range, and I shot expert.
Right.
Now you're going to put an optic on my gun. I'm going to suck. Iron sights are the way to go. You start to fall in love with your own mythology, your own, you know, belief system, not understanding. So it doesn't get a fair shake right off the bat because people don't like new shit. You know, they don't like, this is combat tested. This thing's never failed me. And then one failure or one failure to feed or one failure to extract turns into, you know, oh my God, you know, did you hear about Charlie Company and 3rd Platoon? Everybody's M16 broke. Well, maybe one because he fell down a cliff. You know, but that never, so a lot of this is just word of mouth. It doesn't really, there's no lot of truth to it.
Right.
It had some problems. They fixed them. It was actually a very reliable weapon. If you did what you were supposed to do with it, the problem was, again, Marines and soldiers didn't want to, you know, I'm in Vietnam. I can't afford to clean my rifle. No, that's not true. They cleaned their rifles. You know, there were times you set aside downtime. What were you doing? You were doing weapon maintenance, equipment maintenance, you know, you just didn't sit in your bunk and wait and throw your rifle on the ground and then pick it up and go to fight. No, that didn't work.
You know,
soldiers and Marines in Vietnam were still disciplined.
General Zinni did a PME and he talked about being a company commander. He'd been an advisor. He goes back to be a company commander and he flies over with a lieutenant that was going to come to his company, although he didn't know that at the time. And so he said he was kind of in the company area, and he heard the lieutenant talking to his staff sergeant. You know, they got introduced to each other, and they were standing there talking. He said, I'd like to meet the platoon tomorrow and inspect rifles. And he said, you know, right away, you know, the staff sergeant kind of gave him the, hey, you don't know how we do it here, lieutenant. This is Vietnam. This is combat. This is war. We keep them clean. And he said, you know, the lieutenant was a good lieutenant. He looked at the staff sergeant, and he said, I'd still like to take a look at him. And he said, so I made sure I was kind of in the area where they were doing the inspection the next day. And he said the weapons were filthy. And the lieutenant looked at the staff sergeant and said, I thought you told me that you guys kept them clean. And staff sergeant said, I didn't know this was going to be some kind of boot camp inspection. And he said, but he said, you know, those the basics of being good are the basics of being good. And he said, and it was a good thing for that unit that that lieutenant did not get intimidated from, hey, this is combat, we got this, because that statement is the road to bad things happening. But it's funny. It's funny you saying that brings back that story from General Zane.
Yeah, so when we go down the story, then this is where your namesake comes in. No relationship, but
thank you.
The Secretary of Defense, McNamara, at the time, he loves the F-50 or the AR-50. Don't know why. It's never really talked about. So this is after Fort Greeley. So remember I tell you a story about the winter torture test for the magazines and shit?
You know, yes.
Yeah. So the AR-15 goes to Fort Greeley, Alaska for the same thing. It goes up for this Arctic winter test, and it fails miserably. So Stoner gets on the scene, finds out, well, the shitheads that are running this thing, they're sticking welding rods as tapering pins, and shit just, I mean, the guns are just totally jacked up. And so Stoner fixes them all, puts them back in the hands of the guys, and then the guns perform, you know, amazing up in there. So they're all pissed off about this. Because there's powers to be that don't want it to happen, and there's powers to be that want it to happen. So it gets to McNamara's feet, and McNamara says, you know, hey, let's do this. I like it. And so the ordnance corps of the Army who owned the weapons, they're the guys that design and pick all the stuff right, you know?
Right.
So McNamara has – what he has to do, 1963 or 64 – McNamara, what he has to do is he orders a halt on all building and purchasing of the M14. You know, so if no one is building the M14, right, or procuring it anymore, what's next? Well, here you go, boys. I got this thing called the AR-15. So right away, the Army purchases, you know, 100,000 of them, puts them in service, and they go to... So the first initial buy goes to all the air assault, rangers, airborne units, and special forces units in the Army.
Hua.
Yeah. And then it's redesignated from AR-15 when the Army buys it to the M16. Because the way we used to do naming culture was, if it's got an M in front of it, it's an Army program of record. If it's an MK in front of it, it's a U.S. Navy or Marine Corps project. Or if it's M, it's either Air Force or Army. If it's an MK, it's Navy and Marine Corps, like a Mark 154, 153, Mark 19, Navy, Marine Corps programs of record. And then Army had the M series. So, and just how do naming cultures get named? It's, you know, I tell people, you know, the M27, which is out there today, the IAR, the Individual Automatic Rifle, the HK. You know how that got its name?
Yeah, it was with 2.7. It was doing.
Yeah, we were testing it with 2.7 because they were the battalion that,
well, how come
that
it,
helped
how,
us out. How so we named it the M27.
How come it's 27. An M though and not an MK?
Because when it became to rifles, the way you name rifles and you put them in the inventory, you can't have a mark like that except if they're not. There's like all these rules. So, like we had to mark. Was a Sasser or the we had special weapons.
Mark 19.
No. Like so we had a mark. It was a designated marksman rifle in the rifle squad. It was a one time buy. We bought these things and we called them a mark something. I forgot what they were called. Mark 17 or mark. Anyway, when it came to an actual weapon system like this, the naming convention had to be an M series.
Okay.
And I don't know why. It's just the way it happened. We should have named it a Mark. Mark 27 would have been cool. But, yeah, so the Army gets this thing, and it goes right away to M16. And then, now the whole thing comes into, like, you'll see, like, the M16, the XM16 E1s, and that was what made – that's what came into the M16 A1s, and that was the Ford Bolt, you know, the Bolt Ford Assist. They called it like the bolt closure device or the Ford Assist assembly. That was what made the M16E1, which eventually became the M16A1. And then the Marines started taking ownership of them once they started doing that. And then ammunition, because ammunition drives everything, right?
Right.
So when we stopped making the quantities that we had of the M14 bullet, you know, the 7.62x51 NATO, and we start making the 5.56x45s, and we give it a designator, and it's like the M193 55 grain ball cartridge. Nothing really good about it, but it's kicking out a ton of pressure, man. I mean, that bullet was whizzing. And, you know, we bought all those rifles for just under $20 million back then.
What would that be today?
To outfit the entire force?
Yeah, would it be comparable to what a rifle is today? Would it be cheap by today's standards?
No, back then they were, I mean, if you look at...
And I mean, adjusted for inflation and all that.
Yeah, I still think, no, we did the right thing at the right time back then, because now it's sustainment. You know, now you're just getting pieces and parts. As newer things come available, you just kind of piece them out. And that's kind of the way General Miller looked at this, in the smartest way is you don't want to, and that was kind of my state, you don't replace the whole gun. Do a product improvement, PIP. We called it PIP, product improvement. And so we pipped the gun. So instead of buying a whole new gun, we buy a barrel. We buy free floating handguards.
Right.
We buy, you know, because it's cheaper. You know, $300 a barrel or $250 a barrel. We buy them in bulk like that. And, you know, $150 for rail, you know, it's $400. And you got a whole new gun. Instead of buying, you know, the guns are now, you know, the HK416, they're pricey, man. Like $3,000 a copy, $2,500 a copy.
Wow.
Yeah, hold on, everybody has one.
Here's an email for you. Hey Mac, I'm curious on the AR-15. When you look at pictures from Vietnam, you see two types of muzzle brakes, flash suppressors, whatever you two want to call it. One looks like
a set
of teeth, and the other one looks like it's vented. So, why the difference?
Okay, so the very first one, it's called the prong.
Right.
It looks like they're just prongs sticking out, right? Tuning forks. That's the M16. So the way to look at them is here's the way to tell you the difference. So when you look at the original M16s, and look at them really closely. The prong flash suppressors or muzzle brakes will be normally found on the M16 or the AR-15. The one with the caged rail, so where they look more modern like they are today, that is probably it's found more on the XM 16E1 or the M16A1. And then the other way to look at them too is look at the pistol grip in those videos or those pictures. They started changing the way because the old pistol grips were rounded. They were slick. The back of the buttstock was rounded instead of more squared off. So where it went into your shoulder, the original ones actually were a lot more rounded. And same with the handguards. The handguards in the back where they go to the barrel nut,
right.
They're more rounded right there. And then overall, the plastic on the original guns were shiny. And then as the newer guns were built, they were more matte. They didn't have that gloss effect. And what they found was the more you carry these guns and the more that they did all this stuff, you were polishing. It was ended up polishing that plastic so it was shiny, super shiny.
Right. And for those of us who got issued an M1, A1, you could tell the older weapons because they were shiny.
Yeah, the more you handled those guns, you could just your hands and stuff, you could polish that black plastic with just your hands. And then the metal, and a lot of just small improvements, you know, like on the original one, if you look, one way to tell the original body, if you're looking at the lower receiver, if you look at the magazine release button, the new ones have an actual raised rail that goes around it so it doesn't accidentally get hit, where the original ones were just a button on the surface. So they would act, if you bump something, you could drop your magazine. So that was a fix where they actually put a rail around it, a raised rail, and then put it kind of, what's the word I'm looking for? Not
reset.
Yeah. And it was kind of reset back into the metal. So there's little significant differences, but the prong flash suppressors are found on the earlier guns. Now, it doesn't mean you're going to find a prong one on a newer gun, because they did that too. And they're called A-frame handguards. So instead of like the new ones are rounded, and then the separation seams are at 9 and 3 on the new ones. Back on the old ones, they were at 12 and 6. So there was a left and a right. You couldn't intermix. That's why they went with the rounded and then 3 and 9, because you can put the top one on the bottom and the bottom one on the top. You can change them around.
Here's another email. Mac, I don't know about you, but when I got to the FMF, which was, I think, at about the same time, lieutenants did not carry rifles.
Mm-mm.
Who the hell thought that was a good idea? You know, that's a good question.
I tell that story about Jeffrey J. Schrock and me. I'm a private carrying a radio. We're doing a frontal assault on a hill up on the Alpha Shelf in Camp Orno. And I look over, and we're, you know, we got soft covers on, and we got eight harnesses and the cartridge belt, because it's, you know, we're not body, our flak jet, it's not body armor, it's like basically a flak vest. We're not wearing those either, but we're attacking. We're doing a patrol, and we're attacking. And I look over, and he's got his .45 out of his leather holster, and it's on his landing, and he's just cocking it. And he's going, and he's not pulling the slide, he's just cocking it like a single shot pistol running up, doing the Iron Mike, you know, follow me. And I that's when I kind of like, I don't want to be around that guy. He ain't going to do anything, you know? And so, and I can't use my rifle because I'm on the goddamn radio. So between both of us, we're screwed. You know, the only guy slinging lead is going to be a 45, and he can only shoot things that are 17 feet away. So, yeah, it wasn't until the war happened that we started giving lieutenants rifles.
Yeah, I
mean, and the same with staff and SEALs, because staff and SEALs didn't care either.
Yeah, and which they didn't like to do in training. Okay, I got it. Cause, right.
Yeah.
But what did I get told? You know, we don't want you to concentrate on shooting.
We don't want you to be involved in the fight.
Yeah, we want
you control the fight, not get in the fight.
And you lead it, you coordinate it. That's your job. You lead the fighting to the Marines. It's like
this. That all comes down from history, warfare history. If you look at history and you look at the British, because that's what we modeled ourselves after in the military, British officers, even back in the Zulu Wars, carrying the Webleys, Mark IVs, you know, the .454 revolvers, that's what they used because it was honorable. A pistol always showed in the military was a position of status and power. Swords, if you had a sword and a pistol, you were of some status. Only officers and senior enlisted carried pistols. So it was it was easy to see, you know. So we copied that. I mean, in World War I, dude, they went over trenches with Webleys, you know, blowing the whistle, burp, burp, and they'd have that thing on the lanyard, and they'd go over the side with the pistol. You're like, what in your thinking? Why even take it out? You know, why even carry it? Hell, I don't even want to carry it because I'll just pick up a gun along the way.
Right.
You know, but they did. And it was World War II. Look at that too, man. I mean, they carried 45s. Now, specialized units, like when you look at airborne guys, Normandy, their officers carried Tommy guns. They carried rifles.
The carbine.
They knew, you know, specialized units carried weapons because they knew. They needed everybody in the fight. Marines started doing that later on in the war. But the pistol, as we said one time, and this was not received very well, at all by all these commanders because they took offense to it, and I didn't care. But we were at a big commanders conference, infantry commanders conference, and we were talking about pistols and how bullshit they were. And we looked at them and said, listen, the only reason we carry the pistol today is it's easier to carry the pistol in the chow hall going to Iraq in Fallujah than it is your rifle. Boom! But it was the truth. And people didn't like to hear that. And boy, man, I took face shot after face shot after face shot. And all I did was, then I realized at that point who the good guys were and who the bad guys. Really, I did. And it changed my view on guys I thought were my friends. I was like, you know what?
Wow.
Screw him.
That's
a piece of shit. Huh?
Holy shit.
Yeah. I mean, I cut some ties with some people that I really liked, you know, at that point. But I was like, you know what? If you stand here and tell me that I'm wrong for saying that, that the only reason we carry it is it's easier to carry our handgun, our pistol into the chow hall than our rifle. And you saying that that's bullshit? Then you know what? I don't have nothing to say to you no more. Get out of my face. You're done. I'm done with you. You're dead to me.
But you know what? Because there is no reason. And you've heard me tell
a
story.
There is no reason. You knew it.
I didn't get out that. I didn't get out very often. But let me tell you, I would loan my rifle to guys who came in to do, they were there to hang out or do something. And they'd be going out, and I'd say, hey, sir, you need a rifle? No, Mac, I got my pistol. And I'd say, no, sir, you really ought to have a rifle because there's some shit that goes down, and when it happens, what are you going to do with your pistol? And then they'd look at me like, are you joking? I'm like, mm-hmm. No, you need a rifle. And they would take it, and then they'd come back and be like, hey, man, thank you. Like, okay. But I, like, who would argue with that?
Right? I still have, right now, in my possession, I have a red plastic Beretta 92FS, which is the gun we used in the Marine Corps, right?
Right.
The Beretta. I have a red training one. Okay, that I took from the pool, I think, when I was in Iraq, before I went to Iraq. I took it to Iraq with me. You know why? You know where my Beretta stayed?
Where?
In the armory. In Camp Forno. I didn't take it with me. Why should I? I don't think my Beretta ever left the armory in any unit.
What?
It stayed at Marine Army, it stayed at First LAR.
What did you do?
I took my red plastic one.
And what did you do with it? Paint it black and put it in a holster?
No. I put it in my holster because the rule was you had to have a weapon going to chow. Right?
Right.
In all of my deployments, I carried that red plastic pistol to chow hall and never was questioned once. So I could eat chow. And my friends knew about it. And they're like, Gunnar, you're such an asshole. I'm like, what? And they go, I'm following the order. They're like, that's not really a gun. But it's a weapon. I'll take it out and beat your head over it and kill you with it. So, yeah, it's a weapon. It says weapon. Doesn't say gun.
Yay, good point.
Yeah. And so I used to carry that red pistol to chow every time. And it was just on a little piece of crap brown clip-on holster. So I'd come back. I'd unclip it, throw it at my desk, you know, when I'm done chow. Come back, I'd clip that thing on, and, you know, everybody's like, God damn it, Connor. Seriously? I'm like, what? It's a joke, and I'm trying to make it a joke. You know? You guys take it seriously. This is a joke. So, I'm going to have a big laugh with it.
And I would tell you this, anybody who would try to defend that as that's not a fact, the reason guys didn't want to carry rifles is
a joke.
Is stupid because a pistol is literally worthless. It wasn't a joke, but people say, look, the only thing that that's good for is if you're going to get overrun, you can put it in your mouth and kill yourself.
The pistol caused more friendly casualties than the goddamn, you know, than in the other gun, because people didn't know how to do it. So, you know, they're shooting themselves, shooting the wall, shooting other Marines. It's like, oh, for crying out loud. Oh. I mean, it's just whole. It's just crazy.
Here's another email. I had forgotten about us not taking pistols to the field. It would always kill me. Here the Marines have their rifles to the field, and you would see officers and staff NCOs on humps and other events.
Yeah, carrying their pistol.
With their pistol and it wrapped in plastic in their holster. Yeah. What a joke. What
is would pull those. When I was a gunny, when I found those shit, man, oh.
Hold on, let me finish this. It took at least 45 seconds to wipe out the magazine well of dust, maybe swab the barrel, and get ready to walk down to the armory. What a bunch of jackasses. But you would see that shit, right?
All the time. And it'd be like they wouldn't even try and hide it. At least put it in a black bag.
No.
But they would take a 33-gallon trash bag,
right,
wrap this thing up so it's like, you know, 10 times bigger than it is, and try and stuff it into their thing, and it'd be white.
Yeah, it would look like one of those planes with a sign flying over Huntington Beach.
Yeah. Like, oh. But every time I'd see those, I'd come up. And it was a lot. The corpsmen used to do it a lot. The Navy were really bad at it. I busted my chaplain one time for that. I walked up. We had a little break. And I walked over and I said, hey, chaps, I need your trash bag. Pick up some trash. I don't have one, Gunner. Yeah, right there. Here, I'll help you. Opened up his thing, unwrapped his pistol, stuck his pistol back in there, and then took that plastic bag and walked around and picked up trash. You know, he got it. I need your trash bag, chaps. I don't have a trash bag with me, Gunner. Oh, no, you do. It's right there. I'll get it. And, you know, it's, God, man, crazy shit, dude.
No, yeah, you. But, yeah, I mean,
And you say it loud enough, so he's not going to contest it because he doesn't want to be like the jackass now, right? Because he's been called out. Oh, that trash bag. Oh, yeah. Okay. And, God, you know, it's just everything, dude. All of that was just bullshit. That's what pisses me off about all of that stuff.
No, when you can't link it to reality.
And that's why people don't like me in those attitudes, because I didn't like bullshit. I didn't put up with it. I didn't have time for stupid games. Gunner, just follow the rules. No. Why should I? The rules are stupid. You know, we're going to follow stupid rules. Remember, we have a duty, an obligation to question those things. Are they sound? You know, is it just like, I know it's a huge, huge separation, but Bernardo Simpson, he was ordered to kill people, direct order. Is that a lawful order? No. Okay. But if we're given orders to follow and they don't make sense. It's not your duty to question those things.
It's your moral obligation.
Obligation.
To question.
Moral courage on the ground.
That is the thing about the whole Me Live thing that to me is stunning. When you see him as a young guy, and to me, it's such a tragedy.
Trying to defend his actions?
Yeah, you know, I mean, you know, he's going to college in 1966 in segregated, you know,
the South.
Growing up in Mississippi. His mom is an X-ray technician in a hospital.
Yeah, I mean,
so she's a professional black woman, and he's in college, and he drops out to join the Army. And then when you see him in the initial video that you see, he's in a suit and tie, right? And he's a well-spoken young kid, and you can tell by the way he licks his lips, and at certain times the way he swallows and his lips move, that he's not good with all this, and he's trying
but he's trying to make sense
of it. He's trying to make sense of it, and he's trying to explain it. And your heart just breaks for him, and you think, okay, we get an order issued to us, and when the captain says, and he's quoted repeatedly, you know, anybody in that village that's left in there when we go in there is DC. Men, women, dogs, cats.
And water buffalo.
Water buffaloes. And so nobody said, that's not a lawful order. We can't do that.
Like, hey, cat.
Yeah, hey.
I'll shoot a water buffalo, but yeah. What?
What? Yeah.
What and definitely a cat. But what?
What are we doing? What are we doing? And here you have this, and Mike and I talked about this before, but, you know, you'd like to think you did the right thing, but if I grew up in Mississippi, and I had white officers in Vietnam, and so they go into the village, they're not taking any fire. He said he saw a VC run away, but, you know, there was not too much fighting around My Lai 4 that day. And so so he says that the lieutenant ordered him to shoot a woman that was running. She had her hands in front of her. She's holding a baby, but he says it could have been a rifle. I didn't know. And he says, no, I ain't shooting no lady. You shoot her. And then the lieutenant looks at him and says, you know you could be shot for disobeying a lawful order in combat. Well, he doesn't say lawful order. He says an order in combat. You can't shoot me for disobeying an unlawful order in combat, though. But he doesn't know that. And he's a black kid growing up in a segregated country. What would I have done in the same situation? And I'd like to say I wouldn't have shot, but, I mean, I probably would have said,
you don't know.
All right, okay, that's what I'm supposed to do, and I probably would have done it. And your heart just breaks because that destroys his life.
Yeah, that ultimately leads 29 years later for him to take his life.
A life of just hell, of medication.
Because you see him 20 years after that interview, and he's shaking. I mean, he's sweating. You're right. That's a great – my heart is broken for him because he lived 29 years with that pain, suffering, destroying himself. And – you know, then it was he lost his son in the front yard of his house, and that's when he picks up his son from a bullet hole. You know, he's dying, he's dead. And he says, I looked into the face of my son, and it reminded me, you know, it looks like the one of the boys I'd shot in Vietnam. And he knew right then and that, in his own mind, this was God, you know, this was his payback.
You hear that, and I don't care. I mean, the post-traumatic winning thing we do, I mean, there's some powerful stuff. And we saw it, 12, 13 times?
And it's still at
but
the last,
never,
even the last one, you're like.
Watching Elizabeth Smart, watching Barnado Simpson, you know, those videos are, they're just so powerful. And what, you know, what they went through, and, you know, and especially for him, I mean.
Right.
You know, he leaves college, and I mean, and that's what got us onto that was your moral obligation to the right thing, to do the right thing. If you won't put your hand up and you won't tell the truth, then God help us. And I go back the other day, we were talking about the first thing that the officer of the deck of the Fitzgerald said when the Fitzgerald got hit. When sailors were dying below deck was, I'm so fucked.
Yeah.
Right? That's what you get when you won't do what Mike's talking about. It's disgusting. And they all deserve better. I mean, if you could see, there's a part of a video that we use in there, in this thing. It's part of the Commandant's birthday message in 2017. But I love it because it's in Vietnam and it's infantry Marines, right, hopping up and they start to sprint across the rice paddy. All right, that took gigantic, you know, balls to do that. Wide open in the middle of a firefight, we're gonna run. Let's go, boys! Poof, and they take off. And I get chills whenever I watch that. The courage, that's what Mike and I have seen in our lives. That kind of stuff. And to think that that's repaid by you won't put your hand up and say, hey, sir, that's an unlawful order. It's to me, it's the worst. It's horrible. And it sucks. So,
yeah.
All right. On that, what's the worst? This came out of an email. What's the worst procurement decision the gunner's ever seen? Ooh, this is a good one.
All of them.
I knew you were going to say that.
Now, if I had to put the worst ones in category in order,
yes.
The worst one ever was probably the grit pot
The what?
That's the combat kickstand that has that stupid vertical forearm grip that you push a button and the two legs shoot out the bottom. That, I call it the combat kickstand because the only thing that thing's good for is when you got to pee, you don't want to lay your rifle down on the dirt, you hit the combat kickstand, and those two legs stick and you put your weapon down and lay down. But it's a piece of shit. And what I think is when I see people with that, and cops, there's cops that have it. And if you're listening right now, because some of you guys are, and you know who you are, because I busted you on it before, told you right to your face that's stupid. I'm telling you again that it's stupid. And so when you see shit like that, I'm like, oh, God help us. That was probably the stupidest thing.
Give me another. But I mean, give me another one. Give me a number. Another real stupid procurement decision.
We went with these. They were like a bipod for the saw. The problem was it had an exposed roll pin on it. So once you lean forward on it, it sheared that off. Then it caused your bipods to do 360s and shooting a fully automatic belt fed machine gun when the bipods are doing 360s is not a good thing.
Not a good idea.
No. And so I took pictures of that and sent that back to the procurement guys and said, great fucking idea, boys. Hey, what party are you guys at when you pick this one out? And then, of course, they're like, oh, shit. Yeah. So they put a complete stop using these things ordered throughout the whole fleet. You know, so it's shit like that. I mean, it's like, I mean, there's a ton of them, man. Flashlights. We bought this stupid brick-looking flashlight that it could angle the net, the head could turn over, and it could attach itself to everything. The problem was it just couldn't take a blow. You know? So we always, I think whenever we spent money on the cheap, you know, that was a stupid decision. Because, prime example. Surefire flashlight, the E2 Defender. You know, so it's called the E2 Defender, Surefire flashlight, LED, two lithium 123 batteries. It'll cost you about $300. And so you're like, a flashlight, $300? Yeah. But it's the first and last, if you buy that first, you'll never have to buy another flashlight ever. Ever.
Ever?
Ever.
Whoa.
And so, well, even if you break, shatter the thing, it's lifetime guaranteed, lifetime warranty, you get another one. So that's the beauty of it. So anyway, we buy this brick flashlight, and I think we bought it for like $100 or $89. Well, the problem was you went through three or four of them through a deployment. So you already passed the point of what the E2 Defender would have cost. And then when we did buy the E2 Defender, because I bought it and got trouble for I bought it for a bunch of the guys in the unit. And so we'd use it. I never had to replace one. It never broke. Should I have guys hammer nails in with that thing? And it didn't break. But it's when you buy reliable gear and you're going to pay a little bit more on the front end, it actually saves you money. You know, and I tell people that. It may sound stupid, but sometimes in life, when you pay more money, when you spend, you have an option. And it's $50, $80, or $110. And people go, I'm going to go with the $50. I'm going to save $60. Well, you don't always save $60 because in the end, if you replace that three times and you could have just bought the one for once and it would have been, you know, it would have lasted a lot longer. You see what I'm getting at?
Yep.
You're saving yourself money. And the Marine Corps is not good at that. Neither is any service, actually. They don't look, and the only thing that the one buy was the M27, the HK416, made by the Germans, you know. That one was the one that shocked me like you wouldn't believe. I was just like, holy crap, I couldn't believe this. We made a right decision. We finally did something right. And, yeah, that one really caught me. Like, whoa, okay.
And they, as you know, they took a ton of grief for it, too.
Oh.
Why is this going outside the country? Why are we spending money?
Oh, yeah.
Why are we spending money like this? Why?
Because their Germans make the best toys.
They know how to make the gun. Okay, final question. Hey, Mac, how about the thing that over the course of both your careers evolved to be a great purchase. What did you see that when you joined was kind of carky, and then when you left was really good? I'll tell you what, I got an answer. Boots. When I joined, man,
and uniforms and camis,
black Cadillacs, man, they you got them wet, they stayed wet, blah blah blah. The boots are now they're awesome. I mean, they're
boots and the camis, man.
Yeah.
And the uniform. Probably the best buy the Marine Corps ever did.
Yeah, without a doubt, the uniforms are great, especially the desert ones. I mean, they were relatively lightweight, but they didn't fall apart. Like, remember the Ripstops camis, Mike? That, God, you'd go to the field.
I love those things. I had those with the slant pockets, like the Vietnam. You're like,
but they.
And I used to wear those with my jungle boots. Man, I look like I was just off the boat from Vietnam myself.
But they rip so easily.
Yeah, I know, but they were cool.
They were cool. The biggest thing they did
super lightweight.
They dried out quick, and so I remember wearing them in Quantico, where in the summer you were constantly wet, and they dried out. They dried out quick. They were cool. But I will tell you this, in my opinion, the boots that I wore at the end of my career, I mean, they were awesome. They were great boots. I still love wearing them, you know. And the Bellevilles, for whatever reason, I think they might have snuck in when I was sleeping and used my foot to make their last, because I put that boot on and was like, oh, man, it fit my foot perfectly, which is a little bit wider foot. So anyway.
Yeah. All right, a good one, the boots.
Yeah.
I would have. Yeah.
What do you, anything exciting going on today?
No, going to court for a little bit.
Oh.
Well, no, not for me. I'm just going to go watch Ron.
Oh, really? No. You're going to be a spectator? Will you be allowed to speak?
No.
Hey, Ron, can I make a point here? Can you do that?
Can I interject, Your Honor?
Your Honor, peanut gallery comment, please?
No, I wish.
All right, man. I will talk to you on Thursday.
All right. Talk later.
There you have it. Talking procurement with the man, the myth, the legend. Mr. Procurement himself, Mike's got awesome procurement stories too. Things that you're like, what? That'll do it. We did a little tribute, as it turns out, to Lee Ermey today, and I played some Gunny Hartman stuff yesterday, but Mail Call was what I used to watch the most, and I used to think that was funny. And I always learned stuff. You always have. And you always get to see him do cool weapons. So anyway, you'll stay tuned. You'll hear some of that. We'll do some news headlines. And then you'll get to hear. He reviews the M60 and the MG42, which is the German machine gun that the M60 was based on. So, he fires that. You'll hear him talk about that. So, and then he compares it. He explains the 21-gun salute. And then he compares the M14 and the M16. So, a great ambassador for the Marine Corps, and funny, too, which I think I love. Have a great day. We will be here tomorrow. Tomorrow, Tim Lynch and Jeff Kinney are going to join me. So we'll do that. And then on Thursday, Sergeant Major of the 10th Marine Regiment is going to come on and talk a little bit about post-traumatic winning. So, and then I think Grant Newsham is going to join us on Monday. I was trying to get him on this week, but I can't. And so he'll join us Monday. We haven't talked to Grant, so we'll get his thoughts on possibly a new meeting with North Korea and the British and the Americans in the South China Sea. We're waiting for the Japanese to join them, as well as the Australians, which all needs to happen. All right. Have a great day on a Tuesday. All Marine Radio, over and out.